Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
We want a dynamite from the most wrestling site, AEW, lighting up the fuse. Sit back and enjoy the bubbly, as we hear from John and Waitay. Where we're going, we don't need roads, and if the buck stops here, this thing might blow. Everything you hear, opinions of the show, and if you don't like it, go to the forums and let them know.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Rewind to Dynamite. It is John Pollock. It is Wei Ting, and that means it is time for Rewind to Dynamite. Hello, Wei.
Hey, John. How you doing?
How are you doing? This is show number two of the day for you.
Mm-hmm. I'm doing all right. Yeah. Not that unusual these days.
You made it sound very daunting that you were diving into the G1 midway through the tournament. You seem to have a lot of... I think you were feeling that you were going to be diving into the deep end of the G1, but I can confirm you did a great job.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it can feel that way. I mean, usually I think I'm a lot more in tune with the G1 by this point. But this year I'm just kind of diving in the middle, but, I think, you know, the stories have been, thanks, John. Thank you, Brian, for that. Yeah. I think the stories have been relatively easy to digest, and certainly, you know, hearing reviews from our crew have really helped me follow along. But I quite enjoyed actually talking about the shows. Talked about night 11 and night 12 with Kate in the cafe. And
you had two of the better shows to go through. I would say You got two of, well, certainly we'll talk a little bit about it today. I thought today's match between Takeshita and El Phantasmo was among the best of the entire tournament. Some would put it as high as the top tournament. And when I saw Hirooki Goto's children, I was like, man, Wei's coming in here and he's getting like the ultimate emotional, the most emotional segment of Goto's career. So it was a fantastic environment for today's show. I really enjoyed these Corey Kuhn Hall shows. Yeah.
And I got an evil match that lasted only 19 seconds.
I mean, when I saw that, I was like, you lucky bastard that That's the evil you got. And you got by far the best Jake Lee match. Like, Jake Lee's not touching what he did with Gabe Kidd.
I was like, what are all these guys talking about? This Jake Lee guy's great.
You know, I think Jake Lee has a future Jeff Jarrett plunder match in him, and that'll get him permanent residency in the U.S.
Perhaps, yeah.
L-double-E. Lee versus J.A. Okay. Well, we have lots to talk about. No time to waste. We are going to be diving into the news. But yes, the G1 slog, the riveting wake up in the morning and attack the five matches. However you are consuming the G1, it continues. Another show is coming your way on Thursday as Bruce Lord will be pairing up with Eric Marcotte. So look out for that coming out Thursday. A one-show review that they have with the way this is structured. This is the week. It's really three shows in a row, and then they come back Saturday. And all of a sudden, next weekend is it. The G1's over. Like, I can't say this one has been... There's years that it feels like... very, very daunting. But I have to say, I think this year's G1, it's going by at a nice pace, I think.
The eliminations are starting as of the past two shows, so this is a good time to jump on, too.
All right, let's talk a bit about some of the news items, and we have to bring people up to speed on the latest involving the Janelle Grant lawsuit, because we had several stories over the last 2 days. We're going to go backward. Today, Dr. Carlin Kolker, who was the physician at the Peak Wellness Clinic in Connecticut, which Janelle Grant was sent to see back in 2019. So Grant had filed a they were essentially looking for the electronic medical records from Peak Wellness that they stated the records that they had received were incomplete and inaccurate. That was Grant's perspective on it, and they were looking for these records and stating that, you know, there were things such as IV infusions and different pills that she was given that she was not properly briefed on what they were, that there was a pushback from the doctor, that he had knowledge of the NDA that he once made reference to between Vince McMahon and Janelle Grant, like a lot of serious accusations against Carlin Kolker. It's worth noting Grant was not suing Kolker nor Peak Wellness. They were simply requesting these medical records. And then Vince McMahon had filed a motion to have this bill struck, because by Grant going after these records, the argument was, well, these records are going to aid you in the civil case, which we are supposed to be on a stay. There's not supposed to be any actions taken in regards to the civil suit, and that's what Janelle Grant is trying to do. So on Tuesday, a judge ruled that they struck down Vince McMahon's motion, stating that this is being filed in Superior Court, the federal investigation. It is not going on. It's obviously going on at the federal level, and did not see a problem with them seeking out these medical records. So that brings us up to speed there. Vince McMahon's motion was struck down on Tuesday. It's worth noting that one of Vince McMahon's lawyers did send a statement to WrestleNomics indicating they are going to continue to pursue and try and stop this from happening. How they plan on doing that was not explained, but they did offer that statement on the record. So today, it was a significant denial from Kolker and the Peak Wellness facility denying any improper treatment that Janelle Grant received during the months, actually like an extended period of time that she was going there, and stated that that they are themselves now asking for Janelle Grant to produce documentation. They are stating, in essence, that all of this documentation she has, and she can produce this, and by producing this, the contents of which are going to prove that she is running a smear campaign. That's what Kolker has labeled it, that Janelle Grant is engaging in. They like completely, wholly deny any mistreatment. They run through all of the different allegations and state the all of the damage that they have done to Kolker's reputation, to the facility. And I mean, they are not technically suing Janelle Grant, but this has all the basis of a lawsuit that could come out of this, because they believe they are calling these flagrant and uncontrolled dissemination of lies by Grant that has caused and will continue to cause Dr. Kolker and Peak Wellness irreparable harm and perhaps incalculable damages, well over tens of millions of dollars in damages. So they are seeking these documents from Janelle Grant, and in the exhibit they do list all of the documentation that they allege Grant has possession of and can produce, which will nullify her accusations. They also want to depose Janelle Grant at a time in September, which I don't know what the next steps of this will be, how compelled Janelle Grant will be. Obviously, there will probably need to be a ruling for this, but there's at least a push to have Janelle Grant go through a deposition in regards to the specifics when it comes to the Peak Wellness treatment that she received. So that's where we are now. And they're also seeking additional relief in law or equity that the court finds justified. So, I mean, this was a pretty strong response when it comes to Carlin Kolker and the Peak Wellness facility. Now, I will pull this up because Ann Callis, the attorney for Janelle Grant, did send us a statement as it relates to this filing today by Kolker. And Callis stated that the court sided with Janelle and against McMahon in confirming that she was within her right to seek her own medical records and data from Dr. Carlin Kolker of Peak Wellness. It is perplexing, but on brand, to file an attack against a woman formerly in his care. So this is not really, you know, in terms of any response directly. It's like, really, we're getting two sides here. One stating one set of allegations and the other is completely denying them. So obviously there is probably further filings and battles between these two sides. But it really does pull Carlin Kolker into the midst of this case. And again, the reminder that the stay in the civil case lasts until December the 11th. So there's still a lot going on here in regards to this, but that's the latest on the Janelle Grant front.
Very busy. This entire story. I mean, it sounds to me like Carlin Kolker is well within his rights to, I guess, argue that he's innocent in all of this. At the very least, I think, you know, to protect his own public image. At the same time, is Janelle Grant doing much beyond asking for her own medical records? That, I guess, is the arguable point.
Well, I mean, right? I mean, in the bill of complaint, I mean, like, she did list a lot of things that would be damaging to Kolker's reputation and the reputation of the clinic. Like one side is like, we have two sides to the story, and that is what the courts are designed to be. But if you go into the story I posted today, like, there is a lettered listing of every claim that Kolker is refuting and doing so very strongly. So he is certainly not just and again, he was not being sued in all of this, but you read that bill of complaint, like, you can certainly see where the reputation of a lot more people are probably aware of Dr. Carlin Kolker today. That I mean, and this guy was not, I should say, you know, this guy was a pretty public figure that was out there, but at least in his argument is that this was filed. This was just a request for documents. And the fact that this is linked to such a heinous case, his name is splattered all over. This is covered in so many more places because it's attached to Janelle Grant, which is a major case. And now he is in the midst of this and stating that he is not listed as a defendant in the case himself. It's also, I would also note that in the original civil suit, there is a reference to a celebrity doctor and an alternative clinic, I believe is the wording. I think most people assume that that is who this is. I will state, though, that we have attempted to confirm that that is, and we have not received that confirmation, but a lot of people have, you know, deduced, and that's probably a fair assumption, but it is an assumption and not fact yet.
And one that Carlin Kolker definitely wants to...
Nobody wants to be attached to this case or any of these allegations. So even though there's a stay on this case, I mean, I see this being obviously something that there is going to be movement forward toward, especially if, you know, they're pushing for a deposition and if these documents exist, or what the case is if Janelle Grant denies having these documents. Like, there's many different ways that this can go. But Kolker's side is stating, like, all of these documents she should have, and once she produces those, and if she is forced to produce those, that should exonerate Kolker from these allegations, in theory. But there you have it. You can read the rest of that up on the Post Wrestling site. On to some less depressing news, but important nonetheless for the NXT brand. They're going to be going on the road in October, at least for their first two shows on CW. October 1st, they make the move to the new network, and they will run NXT from the Allstate Arena in Chicago, featuring CM Punk, who has been announced for that premiere. The following week, they will go to St. Louis at the Enterprise Center. Great car rentals from Enterprise, by the way. And Randy Orton will be the one appearing on that show, and probably a slew of talent, because that same night, NXT goes head-to-head with AEW, who will be running Title Tuesday from Spokane, Washington, on October the 8th. So that is our next big head-to-head battle that we will see. And I'm sure we're going to get a loaded-up show on both ends on that particular Tuesday night. But Wei, what are your thoughts? And do you see this as almost like a test run of, like, NXT shows on the road?
Mm.
Or do you see this just being a two-week event, and they will quickly move back to the Performance Center, where there are great savings to staying at the Performance Center. This would be a significant, obviously they can afford this, but one of the great parts about the Performance Center is they do very good numbers on the on USA from their own their own Performance Center, and the atmosphere is not really that affected by it.
Yeah, I'd say that that's more likely, John, you know, coming out of this. I mean, we've seen NXT and the way WWE likes to promote these special edition NXT shows. They stack them. They make them feel like it's essentially a main roster show. I'm sure on SmackDown and on Raw, you'll see plenty of, you know, pushing. But I don't expect this to be a regular, you know, edition of NXT going forward. And therefore, I can't expect them to, you know, sell out places like the Allstate Arena, you know, on a weekly basis. To me, it feels like it's still a model that is very much catered for having one place without that much travel. But, you know, they want to spread the word about NXT being on CW and maybe to another aim. They want to beat AEW, I'm sure, on that Tuesday.
That first NXT show, like, let's assume they're going to give the full court press for promotion. You have CM Punk in Chicago. What is your expectation of how many people you can put in the Allstate Arena for the NXT brand? This is not piggybacking off of a big pay-per-view weekend or anything. This is a standalone NXT show, but you have your top Chicago-based star and probably weeks of heavy promotion too. I mean, are we, like, do you think this is something that, that could do tremendously well, or do you have measured expectations of what they can draw even with Punk?
I think it's interesting because I think like the question is whether or not CM Punk appearing by himself in some sort of special attraction, like he's going to go be there and cut a promo. Is that going to be enough to potentially sell out an Allstate Arena? My gut tells me no.
But would you have him wrestle on the first show?
Well, that's what I'm trying to say. You know, just the CM Punk appearing and maybe speaking, unless it was like, you know, some sort of dream promo battle scenario, maybe that would do something well, but like something special. But at this point, I don't know how special a CM Punk appearance might feel. But CM Punk in Chicago is a different beast, and this place will be loyal to him in any sort of occurrence that is advertised for him. But I do think NXT is going to provide something special. I think simply having CM Punk show up to talk, it might not necessarily be enough, especially if they want to just, you know, do as well as they can for this building. So, well,
you have several months. I would build up a big heel. I want it to be someone on NXT. I don't think you have to transplant a main roster program to NXT, but just have a heel really build something up. And you've got the added hook that it would be Punk's first WWE match in Chicago since his return as well. Like I think, like, go all in. I think to do a, you know, a 15
what's the match?
Minute...
What's the match you would do if you're picking somebody? Because I don't necessarily see him. I don't know if they even have to have him do a singles match. You know, like maybe
you could do a tag. Like you could team him with Trick. I mean, somebody that can benefit from that. You could do that. Like that's
exactly.
That's one option.
Sure. Yeah, definitely. Like with the aim of, you know, giving the rub to somebody else on the roster. Right. Could be Ethan Page on the other end, you know. I don't think having him wrestle is definitely the worst idea. In addition to having him cut a promo, I think you want a full CM Punk experience, at least one that can, you know, benefit the roster that stays in NXT.
All right. The G1. As we mentioned, two sold out shows from Cora Q Hall, and we are now down. Everyone's got two more matches in the round robin stage. And after 11 days, 12 days, we have the A block led by Zack Sabre Jr. and Evil. They're tied with 10 points. And then it's a huge tie with Naito, Sonata, Jake Lee, Gabe Kidd, Shota Umino, Takagi and Okan, all with six, while poor Callum Newman, he's gone at 4 points apiece, but I'm sure you will have many G1s to come. Over on the B block side, Jeff Cobb is alone with 10 points in first place. David Finlay and the G and G1, Goto, tied with 8 points along with Takeshita, Ren Narita, and Yota Tsuji. So you have a five-way tie. Hanare, Yuya Uemura tied with six, and it's El Phantasmo and Oleg Bolton on the bottom with 4 points each. And I thought today, number one, the Takeshita has like clinched performer of the tournament. Like, yes, we still have a week and a half to go. Maybe somebody can usurp him, but my God, this guy is operating at another level. Is that a good thing or a bad thing for the purposes of this year's G1 from New Japan? And what this tournament was designed to be?
It's a really, really interesting question, okay? What do you do if you're New Japan Pro Wrestling and the best performer on the entire tour is a guy that is not contracted talent for you? He's another AEW guy who's just going to go back to AEW after this tournament is over. I mean, if you're New Japan, I think you're grateful just to have this guy, you know, in the meantime, and maybe you could look towards having him for special occasions. But it's probably not great news. You know, you probably don't want the talk coming out of this to be, hey, like this Takeshita guy is really good. But it's better than not having him in the tournament, I suppose.
Oh, no one's arguing that. Like, this is going to be an incredible 4-week stretch of Konosuke Takeshita matches that you're getting. And it's not just the matches that we're talking about. You sit down, and you're a perfect example, Wei. Like, you dropped in the middle of this tournament, and who's the guy that, if I was to just ask you cold, like, you've got no frame of reference, like, we're looking for the next guy that's going to take us into the next era of this company. Is there any dispute on who it is? And this guy has completely outshined, like, Yota Tsuji and Ren Narita, like, Shota Umino. I would say Yuya Uemura has had the best tournament of those four, but, like, no one's been in the league of Takeshita. The guy that has been is Hirooki Goto, which is another, like, great story. Also not your future either, but short-term, this stuff is great.
In a tournament that's missing a Will Ospreay, that's missing a, you know, Kazuchika Okada, I think somebody like Konosuke Takeshita has made up for a lot of that appeal of, like, these matches definitely being a sure thing, some of them being match of the year contenders. To me, it more so shines a light on, like, I think how much AEW has underutilized him. You know, this is a guy that is outperforming this entire New Japan Pro Wrestling roster, and his role in AEW thus far is really just as some sort of, you know, for the most part, a setup guy for your people that you're trying to get ready for championships. So I'm very curious to see if, like, Takeshita benefits from any of this sort of word of mouth and momentum the moment he heads back to AEW, and if he's in line for a bigger push, or if he just goes back to the same role. But for New Japan Pro Wrestling, I think that they have a whole roster that needs to step up and be better than this guy in the years to come. But I will say, you know, like, Takeshita, for instance, in last night's show, provided a great background in order for somebody like El Fantasmo to tell his story, to get a, you know, I would say a definitive moment of his G1, if not, like, maybe even part of his career as well. So that they've been benefiting from that.
Yeah, I just thought this match was off the charts, and both of them were just outstanding in this match. The closing sequence was my favorite of the tournament. Like, it was just so intense with the trading of covers and into the conclusion of the match. Like, this just was incredible. And the other highlights of the show, I do want to mention, I thought today, Oleg Bolton, that was the most complete I have seen him, and it's no surprise that Jeff Cobb was his dance partner in this match, but I've really enjoyed Oleg Bolton. Like, to me, he is someone that he's got his own unique story, and you've just seen these small improvements, and today, like, I'm not, he had a 4-star match today, like, no doubt in my mind. I thought this was just the most complete I've seen the guy, and Jeff Cobb was excellent in terms of being able to really sell, like, the power and the way they incorporated, like, the Bolton shake into this. I just think that Oleg Bolton was a great addition to this year's tournament, and he's someone you come out of. I would love to look back at this tournament a year from now, 18 months from now, because I think this tournament is going to do wonders for his improvements that will kind of come out. Like, I hope that he's someone that gets, like, you know, a good match at the Tokyo Dome in January, and then is someone that's a player come the New Japan Cup next year, and then he's a real force a year from now, where he could seriously make tremendous strides over the next year. Like, this does feel like he has broken out of that, you know, the entry level mode, and now he is, you know, he got his tights, he got his colors. WH always says, you know, that's your anointment. And this tournament, I think he's been, like, a solid addition. He's not going to be anyone's performer of the G1, but everyone, it's a team. It's like assessing a team. Everyone's got some role because you're telling a larger story over 10 different participants. And he's got his own chapter that's worked well for me.
I think one of the things this G1 might be remembered for is I think the brilliance in doing the little playoff that they did in the beginning to have both Oleg Bolton and Callum Newman qualify to enter the tournament. They could have simply had these two enter cold, you know, just be announced as names. But by giving them essentially like a great prelude story to enter the G1 already puts that incredible spotlight on them. And they've just kind of done the rest, you know, like they are telling the audience that these are two performers that you're supposed to pay attention to. And I think the end result is by this point, even though they're both eliminated out of the G1, you are paying attention to them. You know who they are.
And the last point I wanted to mention was Hirooki Goto, who headlined today's show beating David Finley. And it jumps off that last point because everyone was focused on this year's G1 and what was the one line summary going into. It was, who is the next one, the next generation? And no Tanahashi, no Ishii, no Yoshihashi. God damn it, they took Toru Yano out of this tournament. And maybe we should have seen this story coming, that here is the oldest guy in the tournament, the guy that has done 17 consecutive G1s since 2008. And there's a huge part of the audience that are still nostalgic for these guys that they have watched for years and years. And he's kind of, you know, I don't really attach Naito, even though he is, but Goto is kind of representing like the old guard. As much as this G1 is all about the young stars and who's going to rise up, this is Goto that's all of a sudden, he's always like, this guy has never embarrassed himself in these tournaments, year in, year out, always quality. You can always depend on him. And this year he's got that same level of quality, but you've got this story that has just almost come out of nowhere. And today they put him in the main event. You've got his kids there in the crowd watching him. And this was, I thought Finley was a terrific opponent, and just all of the little things he's doing. Like when he does that GTR at the end, it's like he doesn't just take the guy and hits this move. It's such a struggle. So when he hits it, it's this big achievement, and this crowd went insane. They sounded like 20,000 people chanting his name after that win today. And Goto, to me, he has he's right behind Takeshita. And in terms of just the story and the drama, that to me has been maybe the most captivating part as we have just over, you know, 10 days to go in the tournament.
Yeah, I really did not expect one of the stories and standouts of this G1 to be Hirooki Goto. And like the story of, I guess, what is it? Rocky 5? No, Rocky 6. Like, you know, Rocky Balboa, the movie.
Where he takes on Mason the Lion Dixon.
Exactly.
Well, is Takeshita Antonio Tarver?
Yeah, I guess so. If they end up in the final, sure. But it's the story of the veteran who we all kind of wrote off, you know, without having any sort of like world title aspirations, being able to come back and mount like that kind of one last attempt at, you know, at glory above the younger generation that we're all talking about. I love the fact that they're able to tell this story. Absolutely.
Yeah, this is if this image doesn't sell you, this is the Goto story, and I think it's been tremendous. So
who knew this man had a family?
Yeah, he's got a family. That should be so. Yeah, honestly, like if you have not been following along, these two core Q and Hall shows, I think you could dive in, and I think you'll be caught up on all the key stuff for the last stretch of the tournament. So there you go. Those are some of our thoughts. If you want more of them, check out Wei and Kate from Montreal with a full rundown of nights number 11 and 12, which is up now on the Post Wrestling Cafe. All right, just a few more news items, and then we will move on. So Raw on Sci-Fi Monday night, tremendous number. They beat the USA Network on Monday night. What does that tell you? 1,724,000 viewers and a 0.62 in the 18 to 49 demo. And compared to last week's episode, which also aired on Sci-Fi, so it's a fair comparison, they were up 22% in viewers, up 21% in the demo. Third highest demo number of the entire year, which is bonkers. And it, like what they would have done on the USA Network, I mean, it would have been that much higher if they were on USA. But this was their largest demo number since the night after WrestleMania 40. The first hour, which was commercial free, did 1,852,000 viewers. And this was going up against not just the USA Network's Olympic coverage, but on NBC did 14.9 million viewers. Plus, you had a lot of big cable news programming because of the Tim Walz selection for the Democratic Party as well. So you had a lot of cable news coverage going against us as well. So a very strong number, and one of the few times that the U.S. and Canada were in sync, because Canada did 389,600 viewers on Sportsnet 360, its highest number for Raw since March 18th, and second highest since the go-home show for WrestleMania 39 last year. It was number one among sports in Canada that night, beating out the Olympic coverage as well. So very strong episode of Raw coming out of what was a pretty newsworthy SummerSlam. And we still don't know any kind of viewership stats from WWE. I'd be curious if they drop any of that in the earnings call tomorrow. But I have got to think they got a bit of a boost being on Peacock during the Olympics and all the signups over the last 2 weeks that SummerSlam fell in the middle of. And it just seemed that overall, this was WWE is going through a popularity boom, and this was one of their big crescendos of the year. And it seemed like you had a lot of follow up from SummerSlam that led to a big Raw on Monday.
It bodes really well for their upcoming moves, you know, in the new year, both to Netflix and also SmackDown to USA, because if you have a big enough show, wrestling fans will follow.
And NXT, second week of the Great American Bash, doing 534,000 viewers and a 0.16 on Sci-Fi. So that was up 14% from last week in viewers, up 7% in the demo, where they got to see Wesley turn on his Rascals brothers, Zachary / Nash and Trey Miguel. Did you see the turn?
You left me alone.
Yeah, I mean, what was the logic in this one? Like, you got fired without me.
I mean, they're not.
I would think the anger would be the other way around, wouldn't you?
They're not acknowledging that he was fired, I don't think, on air.
Well, he didn't leave on his own volition.
We don't know that in storyline.
Is the story that Zachary Wentz decided, you know what, I'm going to do an indie run. I'm going to disappear for a while, and then when it's okay to come back, I'm going to take indie dates and then end up in TNA.
We shall see. We don't exactly know what the reason is in kayfabe. I doubt they're going to get into the real reason why he was.
I don't think they're going to explore that either. Yeah. But yes, that was the big angle on the show. A hell of a match too for the main event with
Axiom.
Fraxium. Right. They're calling it with the Rascals. I thought there was a pretty decent chance they were going to ship the titles. They did the complete opposite of that. They broke the whole group up. But yes, a pretty good episode of the Great American Bash on Tuesday. And Collision on Saturday. This was the preempted version of the show, airing at 5 p.m. Eastern on TNT outside its normal time slot. And they took the big hit, 189,000 viewers, down 51% from the normal time slot the previous week, and a 0.08 in the demo. This would be the lowest audience for any Collision ever, and tied for second for its lowest mark in the demo. They were up against the Olympics. They were up against the UFC card on ABC, and of course the SummerSlam pre-show was going on. If there was any, like, there's no real way to look at this number other than, I mean, this was, I don't think anyone looks too seriously in a number that's outside the slot. The 18 to 34 demo that you would think would be just ravaged going up against all this stuff, it did not fall that way. Like, everything else fell a lot, but the 18 to 34 demo, like, it was down 11%, but when you look at the number breakdown that WrestleNomics has, like, that audience, like, they wanted their wrestling at 5 o'clock, and there was a lot of people that, you know, they watched the previous Saturday and they found it at 5 o'clock. So, I mean, that was something, but they returned to 8, and we'll get a better idea of the destruction that was Collision at 5 o'clock, the day of SummerSlam.
Do you think this is the optimal time to put Collision on a pay-per-view week against the WWE?
I certainly think I think just being on the same day, we've seen in the past being the same day, it hurts, but I would want it out of a head to head thing. Like maybe you argue it's even better served on the Friday night, or you could air it after. I think regardless, I just think you're going to get hurt on once a month when you're going up against a WWE show, especially a big one like SummerSlam. All right, that's it. All of the news can be found at postwrestling.com.
Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, She feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Get 15% off a set of Brake Best Select, Select Pro, or Import Direct brake pads and two rotors now at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Let's jump into tonight's Dynamite from the Lawrence Joel Veterans Memorial Coliseum in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. And we got to start off with...
Do you have any numbers for attendance, by the way, for this one?
This one, the last number from WrestleTix was 2,738, okay, which is not a big number, but in particular that first match, this crowd sounded like triple that number. They certainly had periods of this show where it sounded a lot better than it was, but it's not like they're knocking them dead going into their biggest show of the year. Like 2,700 is... you know, it's disappointing when you're not hitting even 3,000, much less, you know, 5 or something like that. But this was also a show with Tropical Storm Debbie affecting those in the Carolinas and Georgia. First of all, we hope those affected are safe, because it's some terrible news coming out of this. But secondary, but affecting this show was tons of travel problems, including MJF, who mentioned he couldn't fly, so he had to drive 10 and a half hours to make it to this card. And then Tony Khan had mentioned that he held back on several announcements because of the travel issues. However, everyone they had advertised in advance were there. And I guess the only ones we heard for sure on the broadcast that were impacted were Kyle O'Reilly and Mark Briscoe, because they were going to do a tag with Orange Cassidy against Rush, Beast Mortos, and Roderick Strong, and flipped in FTR. So I'm sure there were others that were impacted. Those are the ones, at least, that we know now. It's actually remarkable, and probably killed any chance of a walk-up, too, in terms of that probably affected things, too.
Well, like, by the time the show was over, it felt like a pretty complete roster to me. So I'm curious to know who actually didn't make it.
Yeah, I mean, the key people were there in terms of, like, you know, having Swerve there, because they did not announce that Jim Ross interview, at least, like, I didn't even know about it until the show began. I don't know if maybe that was one that they were holding off on, because he had a big part on this show. MJF and Kyle Fletcher starts the show. It's an eliminator bout for the American Championship with Don Callis on commentary. MJF is in his U.S. trunks and lowers the flag while Will Ospreay is watching backstage. MJF immediately goes to the floor and cuts a promo on this Australian oaf and tells him to lock up like a man or I'm going to leave. And from the beginning, Fletcher is trying to hit this tombstone, and MJF would just keep escaping and escaping, and then wrenches the shoulder of Kyle Fletcher, the beginning of his breakdown of the arm for the Salt of the Earth, and even makes a reference to the kangaroo kick, which would also pay itself off late in the match. A drop toehold sends Max into the guardrail. Now, I have been one, especially coming out of SummerSlam, I was not alone, that always point out the shoulder into the post. So I've got to be fair here. The amount of guardrail shots on this show, I think every single person in every match was run into a guardrail on this show. Like, it felt as though those guardrails just took a pounding.
Yeah. Okay, so at what point does maybe a spot become repetitive because it occurs in multiple matches? And what point is it just a standard move that you can expect to see in every wrestling match?
Well, I think I'm pretty liberal when it comes to repetition. But when it is just becoming like almost eye rolling, this was it on this show. I just felt it was so overused that it's like the effectiveness is gone from it. It was just happening a lot for me. Maybe not for you.
No, not so much for me. I can't really say I even paid that much attention to repetitiveness, I guess.
Kyle Fletcher, who, like, first of all, these two had a hell of a match. Fletcher hit this incredible Tope Suicida and then an Orihara moonsault. The crowd, again, they sounded incredible here for such a small number. They certainly made up with it in volume here. And Fletcher, you have MJF leaning against the guardrail, and Fletcher runs from out of the shot and leaps over this chair with this somersault onto Max into the crowd. And the way this was shot, it was like this guy came out of nowhere and he just destroyed him. Shivani just remarks, "We are seeing a star being born in front of us." And then MJF cuts him off, stomps the arm, uses a hammerlock DDT and calls him a wannabe Osprey before spitting at him, and Fletcher snaps, returning with all these slaps, and then takes a thumb to the eye. MJF hits a Canadian destroyer. The crowd's going wild for all of this, by the way. And then goes for the Panama Sunrise, which is blocked by Kyle. And finally, Fletcher, after multiple attempts, hits the tombstone. This near fall was amazing. This crowd exploded for the kick out. Callis gets up from the booth, comes down to the ring, speaks to the referee, and tosses a screwdriver to Kyle, who is conflicted and ultimately chooses to throw the weapon away, and Max just capitalizes, kicks him in the balls, and then hits the kangaroo kick before the brainbuster to pin Fletcher at 17 minutes and 43 seconds, an incredible match.
It was a very, very good match, one that showcased, I think, how far Kyle Fletcher has come along as a single star. At this point, it's really hard for me to see him just going back to being a tag team with Mark Davis whenever he's back. He's just kind of advanced so far, I think, beyond that role. But, you know, maybe there's some story to be told with a little bit of a team up and then maybe an eventual breakup. But Fletcher has been one of, I think, the sort of shining prospects of this year's AEW TV show. And this was a match that kind of really solidified his position as, like, you know, without the pillars here, like, he's essentially, I think, one of the up and coming, you know, top rook. I don't even want to say rookie, but like somebody who kind of is in a position that like a Daniel Garcia was at one point. I thought MJF's arm and shoulder targeting offense was really looked really good. It looked really technical, really aggressive throughout the match. And I think Fletcher selling of it was matched it perfectly as well. This was how long, John?
17 minutes and 43 seconds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it moved really well, you know, and it was like the type of, I think, big opening match, especially an MJF match that I think you've come to expect to be, you know, this length and quality. Crowd was into every moment. So, yeah, good match.
Yeah, I would certainly recommend this one. And so if you're wondering, like, you have Ospreay watching in the back and Callis getting involved with the screwdriver, they cut to Ospreay and he's been barricaded in his dressing room and has to power his way out. And he runs out as MJF has taken out Paul Turner with the belt, and he puts on the diamond ring, drills Fletcher in the head, and Fletcher is bleeding as then MJF goes to hit him with the Tiger Driver 91, but before he can administer it, Ospreay rushes into the ring, MJF retreats, and Will Ospreay, I mean, A1 worker here, coming out in his white t-shirt and gets the blood of Kyle all over his shirt as Callis and him argue, and Callis is yelling, "Where were you? Where were you?" And there we have Will Ospreay tending to his best friend.
And yeah, Ospreay was trapped in his room due to some, I guess, obstruction. And I guess the mystery is who locked him into his room. And with Callis screaming, "Where were you?" I guess we can assume that Callis might have had something to do with it. So they're continuing to tell the, I guess, eventual Kyle Fletcher defection of the Callis family story here. Also maybe leading to a bigger war with Will Ospreay and Don Callis as well. So you know, you expected the post match to go this way, right? You know, Kyle Fletcher getting beaten up to just further heat up the feud between Will Ospreay and MJF. So things are a little bit more personal for Ospreay heading into All In.
Mariah May versus Viva Van. So Mariah May immediately headbutts her and just starts destroying her. She hits her with a German, with a missile dropkick. She's dominating this match as they go to picture-in-picture. And watching the picture-in-picture portion, just continue to dominate her. Taz says, you know, it's been about 90-10. I'm like, where is this 10 that Viva Van has taken? And with that, Viva Van hits a upkick to Mariah May, who just immediately tosses her into the buckle, hits a hip attack, and then kisses Van, running knee strike, and the Mayday, but doesn't go for the pin, instead winning with the Storm Zero in 6 minutes and 28 seconds. On one side, I don't think this is the time to do a 50-50 match with Viva Van, but this was very long of just a destruction of this woman that I don't know if it's necessitated a picture-in-picture break, but it was certainly a dominant win going into her title match.
So this could have been one of those segments where maybe they had something else that was affected by the storm that might have necessitated this being extended. Because I agree, I don't think a match between Mariah May and Viva Van needed to go 2 segments. I think if that was the case, they might have done a bit more work to introduce who Viva Van was to an AEW Dynamite audience. As far as I know, this might have been her debut on Dynamite. It was a decent showcase for May. You know, I thought she looked kind of nicely smug, you know, as a character. Otherwise, the match was kind of forgettable. And I unfortunately can't say Van made too big of an impression here either, but she also wasn't given much space to be noticed as well.
No, she was the rag doll for 6.5 minutes. But the big segment came after, as May receives this giant gift in black wrapping paper, so you can see where this is going. And she opens it, and it's this photo of Storm holding Mariah May in her arms. And then on the back, it reads, "Die, Mariah, die," as Toni Storm appears again in the ring, all in black, and this crowd goes insane for Toni Storm. They're chanting for her as May gets the shoe, but Toni takes the shoe away, and you have all these officials separating them. They're trying to break free, and the crowd's going nuts. So, you know, the match was what it was, but the post-match, man, did the crowd get electric for this. And it's felt like a big match by the end of it. Like, this crowd, they responded very well to this pull-apart.
Yeah, I would say this was a better appearance for Toni Storm, just coming out and just, like, you know, being purely physical and attacking, rather than having her come out and actually, like, cut a bit of a promo in whatever type of new character she was trying to portray. I think just keeping the characters silent and doing this sort of physicality is a much better way of, like, presenting a sort of a babyface seeking revenge.
Jack Perry, we had a very elaborate video where he is watching VHS highlights of Blood and Guts and nearly being lit on fire. And he's watching it on all these television monitors. So he grabs an axe and he goes to destroy the TV monitors while stating that everything in life has a price. The question is how much you're willing to sacrifice for it. Those who shape the future carry the burden of destroying the past. And I can't say I had too much reaction to this video, but when I read in John Cena's report that on the TBS version that midway through this cut to a Taco Bell ad, I found this extremely entertaining.
It cut midway to a Taco Bell?
I did not see this on my feed, but I was not watching the TBS feed. So yeah, it seems like they worked it. Maybe this is the new product integration that they're finding. See how well that works.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Interesting.
Yeah, maybe they're going to order like the scapegoat tortilla or something. Maybe that will be their promotion.
So, like, as he was like watching this footage, there's a shot.
You do have the television monitors, and then to cut to this, I mean,
oh, interesting.
I would have loved to. I would like to see this commercial interruption during this particular promo. But
all right,
Darby responds after the break, explaining why he did not light Jack Perry on fire. Not because there would probably be 25 to life attached to it, but because then Jack Perry would have an excuse not to appear at all in, because I was burnt to a crisp. So he says, you hardly show up anyway, but I'll be wrestling on Rampage Friday, and you have to show up at Wembley. So pretty subdued promotion for this match on this show. We got some promos, but that was that.
You're getting the flamethrower on the go-home show, probably.
Yeah, yeah. You don't want to get to the heat too early. So something crazy in 2 weeks' time. Brian Keith and Katsuyori Shibata with Jericho and Big Bill on commentary. Jericho notes his finger is still broken, but did get 4 stars from Dave Meltzer for his match with Minoru Suzuki. Shibata goes after Brian Keith's arm, which was previously injured by Shibata, but then Keith turns the tables and he goes after Shibata's arm. Shibata at one point puts his hands down and just tells him to come and attack, and this forces Keith to land some strikes before Shibata comes back. He hits a sweep, uses the claw, which they explain has been handed down to him from the Von Erichs, and then immediately transitions from the claw to a straight armbar. Something Fritz should have used, I think, to update his submission skills. And he wins in 7 minutes. Shibata does.
The match was just kind of there for me. I don't know if I can necessarily speak to it being really good or bad. All the work, I think, looked really solid. And don't have much else to kind of say about it.
Well, Big Bill had more to say about it because he jumped Shibata with Jericho joining him. And they hold Shibata up for the belt shot when Hook's music plays. And he makes his return. Jericho bails out of the ring. And it really feels like we're going the trio's direction for All In, would seem likely.
Yeah, we are going. Now, didn't we just have the match? Is this a rematch that we're getting?
Well, that was before a man was put through a drywall on a forklift. Okay, so.
Right.
Okay. I'm thinking they shouldn't announce Samoa Joe for All In, and he just appears with a forklift and comes down the aisle with it.
Okay, all right. Yeah.
Or he emerges from the rubble that he was left in.
No, how would that work with this being a different place?
He transports.
The rubble?
Yes.
They just brought a...
Maybe it can be an animated recreation of what happened after the forklift disaster.
We shall see.
Rush, Beast Mortos, and Roderick Strong. This is where they explain the travel issues. So they are going to be having a match against Orange Cassidy. And Cassidy is with Renee and says he has found some local guys to help him out and asks Renee if she wants to wrestle. She does not. And then Renee interviews Hangman Page after the break. He's coming off of multiple losses and says there was one man that I wanted to leave with nothing. But then a bunch of dumbasses got in the way. I will get what I want.
I'm still really enjoying this, new, darker, sadistic Hangman Page. He still feels like somewhat mysterious and fresh to me.
Does he need a match on All In, or could he benefit from just he shows up when you least expect it and does something at All In?
Well, can't you expect him to take part in the Casino Gauntlet?
That's a great point, because that could... That could set up his title match. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. He could maybe end up in that, which was announced tonight with a Casino Gauntlet match added to All In. Jim Ross does a sit-down with Swerve Strickland, and Ross says, I don't think fans realized what they could miss. And Swerve agrees. This is going to be a big match. It's important. He said, Ross asks, you've done some controversial things. Do you regret them? And we don't name these controversial things. Instead, we just speak speak vaguely about, you know, breaking and entering and threatening a baby's life. But says, if you knock at the door and they don't answer, you got to make some noise. Now, Jim Ross probably took that figuratively. That literally is what he did. He knocked at the front door.
I would suggest Jim Ross knew exactly what Swerve was talking about, because Ross actually says, I understand. So Jim Ross understands breaking and entering and threatening a child.
You know what? Sometimes
you got to do it. You got to make some noise.
You got to get a title shot.
Yeah.
And Swerve explains he knows what Danielson has left. He says, I'm fighting for my legacy. And if the roles were reversed, would anyone give a damn about me? I control this company now. I don't care about him as a father. I don't care about his family. And brings up Danielson's health, his neck issues, the nerve damage. And everyone always brags about how dangerous they are. Well, how does what matters is when those things don't work, then what can you do? And that's what Danielson, he is going to be without the use of his limbs. He's going to be compromised and he's not going to be at 100%. Then what will he do? How dangerous will he be? And once I beat Danielson, his legacy will belong to me. Home run here from Swerve Strickland.
Yeah, he was great. He was great. So I feel like it's been a while since we've seen JR in one of these, and
he's been through a lot of health issues. A lot.
Yeah, you can kind of,
and it was evident here. Yeah,
yeah. He looked a bit skinnier, you know, than usual. But I think we're all happy to see him continue to, you know, be well enough at least to make appearances like this. I think it's great utilization of a familiar face and voice in him, and I also think he has the ability to make like. Often what are pretty ridiculous, you know, sort of conversations sound very real. I thought he and Swerve had a very organic sounding, like maybe, you know, on probably like only bullet pointed and not scripted at all type of conversation. It sounded like these two were having a genuine interaction. And I thought Swerve did really well in continuing to, he's got a very interesting role in all of this. He has to ultimately still be a babyface coming out of All In, but going into it, he's definitely leaning more towards embracing all the boos. So he has to continue to play determined babyface who is ruthless and isn't afraid to get booed against the sentimental favorite.
Yeah, I like to be quite honest, like I'm waiting for Danielson, and maybe you wait, you don't want him to do that now, but that big kind of rah-rah, I'm going in, like that big promo on that last Dynamite to go into this, because I think Swerve has just been so great as I know this is the storybook ending, but the story ends with me because I am the champion now. I'm the most dangerous guy. And I think Swerve has just been great in this role as Danielson's, you know, the guy he has to get past to get this belt.
It's been great to see because I don't think it was that long ago when, you know, Swerve was a fresh champion. And I think a lot of people were still looking to Will Ospreay being the guy heading into Wembley with the championship or at least vying for the championship. I think we can't state how much Swerve beating Will Ospreay has done for Swerve and has allowed him to just be, you know, be in this position as a defending champion, feeling like a defending champion, feeling confident and without the distraction, at least, you know, from the audience of thinking that he shouldn't be in this spot, that it should be Will Ospreay instead. Swerve feels like he belongs in this spot. He's living up to the top billing of being a Wembley main eventer in this build. And it's been very exciting to see.
And then Prince Nana walked in, and him and Jim Ross did the dance together, and that's how the segment ended.
I think I missed that.
Oh, did you get the Taco Bell ad? Orange Cassidy and FTR. FTR are the surprise partners, taking on Roosh, Beast Mortos, and Roderick Strong, with Taven and Bennett sitting in the front row in their corner. So FTR come out. They've got jean jackets on.
I don't know if this was like legitimately a make good because Kyle and Mark Briscoe couldn't make it. But I think this is a hell of a make good. Like this.
Oh, I think this was complete. Like this was a last minute call when the travel issues occurred. I totally think this was.
It made for a wonderful special attraction.
Yeah, I mean, you had them out here. Their orange is in the FTR shirt, and then both of them are in jean jackets, and they have their shades where Cash looks a hell of a lot like Austin Gunn here, and Dax is just, he's got his Brett shades, which is probably one of like a dozen he has of these.
Yeah, I'm sure he has plenty of them signed.
So another really strong match. They got the advantage on Wheeler onto Cash Wheeler for the longest time here, including a triple team. This is one of those AEW matches where you take a moment to watch, and it's like, I love the idea of watching Cash Wheeler and Beast Mortos in the ring together, or seeing like Roderick Strong in there with Dax Harwood. It's like just all these weird combinations that you can just on a dime put together. So long heat on Wheeler until Dax gets the tag. And then we kind of just started over where they got the heat on Dax for a long period. And all this builds to Orange Cassidy, and he's in with Roderick Strong, and him and Beast Mortos. He hits this incredible multiple revolution DDT. Then the beach break is hit onto Roosh, who kicks out at one, and Mortos misses Cassidy diving over the guardrail and taking out Bennett and Taven by mistake. Strong takes a stun dog on the floor. And then the bull's horns, is stopped by an orange punch. Roosh then drills Cassidy, and he's left with Cash and Dax. They're trading blows, and then Orange returns for another orange punch, sending Roosh into the shatter machine for the win.
I thought it was... at this point, we've kind of come to expect, you know, the conglomeration to be responsible for these, like, excellent trios matches in the middle of the show. You typically against, like, a bit of a randomizer team. But at this point, like, we got Beast, Mortos, Roosh, and Roddy kind of being a pretty constant trios that I've been really enjoying. They're, like, coming up with, like, great three-way patterns. They actually feel like a real team and one that I want to see a bit more of. So I really enjoyed this match. Whether or not FTR was originally planned to be part of this, I thought it made for, again, a wonderful sort of special attraction. These are the type of matches where you don't really need a whole lot of story. Like, I've come to expect just, like, great trios action in the middle of the show. You hit the randomizer button and just, like, let's see what happens. And typically, it's usually pretty good.
Yeah, and it was Roosh here taking the fall. And if anything, maybe story-wise, that maybe had to take a back seat here was, obviously, they're building to Beast Mortos and Mark Briscoe, but we didn't have Briscoe on this. So after the match, the Acclaimed come out, and Max Kassler's mic is dead. So Dax says, it's not just North Carolina, but the mic people also don't want to hear you speak, and says that Dax is... You know, I'm not as eloquent as y'all. And he issues a challenge to the Acclaimed. And then we get another security wall keeping these two teams away. I really like the segment with FTR and the Acclaimed on Collision. Like, they are trying to kind of morph the Acclaimed away from, like, the rap and put them as more serious. A more serious heel unit. And that they have a Dax to grind with FTR. And, this was
weird. Like, first of all, like, I think the caster coming out with his mic cut off, seemingly like for no real reason. I don't know if that was intentional. I mean,
Dax was really quick on his feet.
He was very quick on it. But then, like, somehow, like, Dax's promo kind of, like, derailed. You know, like, what was he trying to, you know, mount to start talking before he started saying, I'm not very good with my words, so let's just fight. Like, if that was intentional, I don't think it really came across as effective, I want to say. So I would
this
say
this was not smooth. I think we can state that.
Yeah, overall, I was just kind of left feeling like this was maybe not the way it was supposed to go.
There's a Collision recap involving the Trios tag title. So basically, we have the Patriarchy, the House of Black, and Bang Bang Gang. And they go to the Patriarchy, where Killshot is not allowed to hold his title. We have Mother Wayne and Nick getting to hold the titles with Christian. And
Mother Wayne looks great with the championship, by the way. I love this Trios.
That's a great... Look at Nick here. So Christian explains that it's going to be House of Black against the Bang Bang Gang Saturday on Collision, and he will be the special referee. The winners go to All In to challenge them for the belts. So do you think that this ends up with a three-way, or do you think they're going to give you a winner on Saturday?
I think it ends with a three-way. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm watching just so many of these programs, and it just feels as though we're going to get a lot of... these matches? Types of scenarios where it's just gonna, like, same with, like, FTR and the Acclaimed. Like, I think they're all getting the match at All In.
Oh yeah, yeah, it's gonna be like a, I don't know, 15 match show.
This might be the longest show in AEW history. It's my prediction. Then there was a video feature on Hologram and Camille, along with Mercedes, with Mercedes in her corner, I should state, taking on Jasmine Howe and Clara Carter. And Camille drops Howe with a kick, and Clara Carter just watches this and tries to run away. So Camille grabs her, throws Howe off her back, and then Howe and Carter manage some kicks in the corner. Camille goes for a double clothesline, but only connects with one of them. The other somehow avoided this.
Intentionally.
Okay. It looked...
She evaded it so that she could take the kick afterwards.
Okay, great defense. Hits a pump kick, and then the torture rack slams Howe and a dominator on Carter, pinning both in 2 minutes and 2 seconds.
I thought it was a better showcase for Camille than last week. The 2-on-1, I think the whole thing just helped her, you know, feel more like a monster. I also think her offense is look good this time around. You know, in terms of skill. Like, just to compare it to a similar type of, archetype for the division, I think I would already place her above Jade in terms of, like, ability. But obviously, aura is a very different story. You know, Camille has it, but Jade is just kind of on a different level. Crowd gave Camille a pretty decent response here. I personally think it probably could have been better, maybe should be better, just given that, you know, this is Mercedes Moné's heavy. I do love the interactions that you're seeing between Camille and Moné, though, where Camille is refusing to have her own hand held up. Instead, she chooses to hold Moné's hand up and as if Moné's won the match. And it's Moné walking out in front of Camille the whole time. She's just completely like subservient to Mercedes Moné. And I just find it to be a fun dynamic between the two.
Yeah. I mean, you kind of grade this as like they're in this holding pattern with, not even so much, because you did get a Britt Baker segment here. So Moné is in the ring and tells Camille to remove the opponents from the ring and says, Baker isn't here, so don't chant for her. And this crowd did not start chanting. Like, it was almost like she was prompting them. She says Baker is still suspended and she won't be back until All In. Baker might have been the first female signed to AEW, but she's not the best. I'm the best. And then Tony Schiavone gets on the microphone and states he has a message on behalf of Christopher Daniels that Tony Khan has overruled the Elite.
Why did he wait so long?
How many authority figures do we have stacked upon each other? Like, we have Christopher Daniels speaking for Tony Khan, who has power over the Young Bucks, and
I think it's just really lazy writing.
I hate this.
Yeah.
This whole thing that this has not been given. This is one of the main stories. I am anxiously looking forward to them ending this whole I hazard to even call it a power struggle. It just seems like matchmaking device is what this is, and it just makes no sense.
They've been very sloppy with it, and they have not really treated it with, I think, the type of care that something like this needs. And maybe you can argue that, hey, like, it's just wrestling, don't think so hard about it, but man, if you just kind of casually throw those things in there, it's hard for me to care. It's hard for me to care when a babyface is about to face the Elite to eventually get rid of this entire thing with them in power. It's just making it harder to, I guess, suspend your disbelief for.
So Schiavone explains that Britt Baker is here via satellite. So Baker appears on the monitor, on the screen, and says that Mercedes can't stop her. She says she sees things until the end, unlike Mercedes, who, as soon as she runs into trouble, takes her ball and goes home and says, everyone knows Mercedes. Let's be real. AEW is just the flavor of the month for you. And this is my home. And this ends it all in when I become the first female to beat you in AEW. And I'm returning next week to get my hands on you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Whatever is the status of the handicap, of the suspension, I did feel like it probably handicapped these couple weeks with this feud. I didn't think that there was much reaction to tonight's segment with Baker on satellite and Moné trying to, you know, create a bit of heat here. I thought Monet's promo was actually very generically heel without saying a whole lot. And I was a bit turned off by, like, how uncreative and lazy they were with the excuse for, you know, lifting the suspension.
I thought this was the weakest segment on the show. I thought both it did not click for me well. You had the handicap of Baker's cutting this promo, like, in a room without working off the crowd. But it still was just, I don't know, something has certainly been lost, I think, a little bit in this program since the announcement, where they were so hot when Britt had just come back. And you had this real-life suspension that got, like, certainly threw a monkey wrench into the middle of this. We'll see if they can pick it up next week.
So because this storyline has, and really AEW in general, has kind of made a name for, like, introducing real-life controversy into promos, do you think they address the suspension, like the real reason for the suspension in subsequent promos?
No, I think you would have hinted. I think you would have hinted at that already. I mean, what are you going to reference? Like, it really has nothing tied to Mercedes. Like, in what way does that build the match? Do you risk, like, healing Britt Baker if you go and introduce that? Like, maybe not, but does it enhance this match in any way?
I think they will look for any sort of reason to get to give the audience a, oh, I can't believe she went there type of reaction, as, like, you know, one of the potential ways that they might elevate interest in the match itself.
Maybe Mercedes adds Alicia Toot to her group.
That would be interesting. Yeah. I don't think they would do that, but I wouldn't put it past them to like come up with some.
Well, you're stating like referencing it. Like, how do you even reference it then? Like,
there could be a line. I mean, she referenced Monet leaving the WWE and taking her ball and going home. I'm sure you could say something to that, to sort of that way of thinking.
I don't think they're going to go that direction. I just don't see it, how it enhances it. Like, but nothing would surprise me if they get that some dig in, but I really don't know how well that lands for people. Like,
I think it's fair if it could be done tastefully and if it could be done effectively.
Effectively would be the key issue for me. This month on the Post Wrestling Cafe, it's your chance to travel back to November 2004 as Wei Ting and I review WWE Raw, featuring Trish Stratus and Lita headlining the show. Bruce Lord and Karen Peterson are going to be covering New Japan's Destruction in Kobe event, and MCU Later tackles Agatha All Along. All of that, plus Rewind to SmackDown and Collision Course weekly, and ad-free versions of Rewind to Raw and Dynamite. $6 a month unlocks it all at postwrestlingcafe.com. Next week, Claudio will have a face-to-face with Okada after winning the shot at the Continental Championship. They have not outright stated this is at All In, but I think that's where people are assuming this is going to be.
Perhaps. Could be for All Out, and that's perfectly fine, too. Not everybody needs to.
Title Tuesday in October, head-to-head with NXT. They're going to get the jump 2 months out.
But Okada Claudio feel like I would expect Okada to be on All In. Yeah,
I would too. And then the main event, Ricky Steamboat comes out, and he is on commentary. What did you think of Ricky Steamboat's involvement here?
Good. Yeah. Didn't get physical, didn't need to. Like, sounded, you know, coherent on commentary. I think had, you know, I don't know how closely he might be watching AEW, but I wouldn't even expect
He was to. He had enough that he could react to questions and just tell the basic story. There was a moment, if you were listening closely, whether it was just a lapse or couldn't remember, like, he clearly was struggling to remember who Swerve Strickland was, because he had to refer to that guy's dangerous or something to that effect, and did not have the name off the top of his head.
That's fine.
Jeff Jarrett just turned 57, by the way, last month.
Amazing.
So, and does here a 15 and a half minute match with Bryan Danielson. And they did like your old, like Memphis, like Tupelo concession stand brawl match, which was probably deep on the list of Danielson's to-do list before All In. So did it with Jeff Jarrett here. Jarrett immediately attacks Danielson from behind with the guitar during Danielson's entrance, and you see Karen and Lethal come out, and it's almost as they're caught off guard that Jarrett would go this direction with Danielson, and they're trying to explain on commentary that, you know, Jarrett is trying to bring everything to Danielson. It was almost like to ready him for All In, which if you ever have to get me ready for something, Wei, please don't hit me from behind with a guitar. Just like, there's a better way for you to motivate me.
Sure.
The guy with the bad neck, and he takes a guitar shot from behind.
Well, when I'm 57, maybe I'll be thinking differently. Yeah.
So they fight into the crowd. They go into the concourse, and we've got garbage bins. There's food being thrown. Jarrett takes a snap suplex onto a trash bin, and they eventually make their Wei back to the arena. There's a chair being used, and then Swerve and Nana are seen in the back watching. So you know that they're going to get involved in some form or fashion later. Danielson fires back with strikes, hits a suicide dive, and then drop kicks Jarrett with a running drop kick as Jarrett is seated in a chair against the guardrail, and then goes for the running knee off the apron, but Jarrett uses a chair to block, and this is when he attacks the knee. Wraps the chair around the knee, but Danielson gets to his feet, and he uses the chair, does a spider suplex, and then Jarrett comes back and gets the figure four on the injured knee. Danielson uses a chair to break it, and Steamboat, in breaking down the figure four, notes that that's a shoot hold. A shoot hold.
Excuse me. Choked? Maybe it can be. You know?
It can be. I think all these moves should be shoot holds from 8 till 10 Eastern time. But nonetheless, Steamboat gets the pass. There's a stroke onto the chair by Jeff Jarrett for a two count, and then he applies the sharpshooter. And they suggest maybe this is a nod to his former partner, Owen Hart. I thought, you think? Danielson counters to the LaBelle lock. Jarrett gets free, and then Jarrett, doing all the Owen hits, nails him with an enziguri, but Danielson stops another attempt at the stroke, running Jarrett into the chair that is set up in the corner, and then lifts the chair, runs into him with a busaiku knee with the chair, pinning Jeff at 15 minutes and 27 seconds.
I thought this was a hell of a match. I was so impressed by Jeff Jarrett here. At 57, for him to maintain this type of pace, taking this sort of punishment for this style of match, it is such an impressive and incredible feat.
I think he's doing the G1 next year.
At this point, I'd be down for it. I think he'd be motivated enough, and he could probably show those guys a thing or two. Jarrett came into this match in incredible shape, and that is to be commended. He also, like, beyond just, I think, keeping up with Brian, he did a very convincing job of applying the pressure from the start and creating that sort of, like, difficult, violent obstacle for Brian to overcome by, you know, providing, I think, a great underdog comeback. Like, that's no easy role. He's the one who has to do most of the work in this match, at least, you know, in terms of activity, and he lived up to it. This was such an impressive performance from him. And a great story in the background of it all, you know, between obviously the sort of Owen influence and also just him wanting to motivate Brian to make sure that, you know, he's ready for sort of it all in. I wish the crowd was a bit more receptive to some of those spots, in particular, like the Owen spots, which I thought would have received bigger reactions, but didn't necessarily tonight. But I think I really enjoyed this match. This was actually my match of the night, you know, just in terms of my own interest and reaction to it. And well worth adding into, like, Brian's catalog of final matches on TV.
Yeah, I would, if this was 2 months ago and you were to outline this to me, and granted, I would still be impressed with Jarrett doing this type of match with Danielson, but I certainly would have pushed back at the idea of Danielson having such a struggle with Jeff Jarrett, of all people, before you're going into the big show of the year. But I think Jarrett has just caught something with fans, that there's just this this fervor behind him at this point, that I think that this just worked. Because in another scenario, I think this would have been a great role for, like, a Jon Moxley to think that Danielson is not pushing himself hard enough, and it's his equal that needs to bring that out of him. But I think, like, you got something here with Jarrett, and instead of just dropping things after the Owen tournament, this was like a nice, like, follow-up to that momentum that he received from this. And they structured the right match, I think, to get the best out of here. I agreed with you. I think, like, there were, like, I do feel this audience, they certainly weren't at the level they were earlier in the show, but overall, I think you have to really commend, like, Jarrett for having this level of match with someone like Danielson, that I think achieved the story that you wanted here of this guy being pushed. And we should also note that after this, Jarrett had this big gash by his ear, and was just they suggested it might have been the final spot with the busaiku. I don't know what cut him, but there was a lot of blood coming from, like, behind his head or around his ear. And they're both just kind of selling the effects of this match as Steamboat comes down. He's checking on both of them. And then you've got Team Jarrett out. Yuta's in. It's almost like a fight where the seconds are coming in to pick up the debris of these two humans. And then the two embrace and hug as Steamboat raises their arms. But if you're looking down, you knew the show wasn't going off the air at 10:02 or whatever time this was. We were going to get our healthy overrun, because Swerve Strickland's music plays and he comes out with Nana and states that we have three legends of TBS programming here. Jeff Jarrett, I don't know if Thunder qualifies as a, you know, being a legend of TBS programming, but let's just run with it. Ricky Steamboat, and now me. And I thought that was just such a great line here. Mm-hmm. And tells Danielson that all three of us defined pro wrestling on this network, and we've all been world champions, unlike you, Brian. And it's going to be an honor to end your career when your legacy becomes mine, and I'm not going to hesitate to take that kill shot. And starts to assess Brian and says, how are you feeling? How's that arm? How's that neck? And says, if that's what Jeff Jarrett does to you, imagine what I'll do at All In. And Swerve says, I want to be tested too. And he turns his attention and he challenges Wheeler Yuta for next Wednesday in Norfolk, Virginia. And he wants Brian Danielson to have a front row seat to show him why he's the most dangerous man in AEW. I thought Swerve was just fantastic on this show. And I think man, you are probably going to get something very violent next week. That should probably be enough to like really push Danielson over the edge into like this killer mode. And I think Wheeler Yuta has to be the collateral damage next week.
Poor Yuta coming in here.
Sorry, that's the role. That's your role.
He's playing Kyle Fletcher to Brian Danielson. Everybody kind of has their lackeys.
He's Apollo Creed going into fight Drago next week.
Sure.
And we got Sylvester Danielson here.
Well, listen, that's the type of edge we need from Swerve, you know, heading into All In as a dominant champion. Again, he kind of has to find that balance between like being a vicious heel, vicious babyface that we can respect, and maybe not veering so much that he actually ends up being a heel. So I think he's balancing it pretty well. Great presence, I would say, from Swerve on the microphone. You know, he's leaning deeper into just, I think, the sadistic side of him that I think we all enjoyed. And it's preventing the need for him to struggle to get cheered over Brian. And I'm really enjoying him. So he's been great. Thank you, chat room, for informing us that afterwards they released footage online of Jarrett getting attacked by Hangman Page backstage. So that is seemingly either leading to a match on TV or maybe even for All In.
Yeah, that could be the All In match as well. So there you go. Thank you for informing us. All right, that was Dynamite. I think the strong parts of the show, I thought Swerve was excellent on this show. My match of the show was MJF and Kyle Fletcher, but I really did enjoy the main event presentation of it all as well. And the angle afterwards with Swerve, I thought, really capped that off nicely. The lower points of the show, I certainly felt the Mercedes Baker segment left a lot to be desired. And I guess that was like my one big negative on the show. Mm-hmm. and a lot of guardrail spots.
Yeah, I think this is a show that didn't necessarily feel like it was like a big all-in episode. Like or at least like it didn't feel like it was one of those can't miss editions of Dynamite like we had for at least several weeks in a row in the lead up to like Blood and Guts, for instance. Several of those weeks of Dynamites felt like they were like, wow, you have to watch it. I wouldn't say this one felt that way. To me, like the most special match of the evening was Danielson versus Jarrett, because you got to see a 57-year-old Jeff Jarrett having just like an incredible performance. The rest was maybe necessary for storyline, but I wouldn't necessarily say they're matches you even had to see. So and I think AEW needs to, they're struggling to have that sort of feeling for every single one of those. So I'm curious to see what the rating will be for this one.
All right. Well, let's hear from you. If you have any super chats, send them our way and we'll go to the forum as well.
Pete, let's go to a super chat here from Pete from Texas, who sends $10. Thank you, Pete. He says, Uncle Dave said Takeshita should be New Japan champion. How was he not signed by New Japan to begin with? I don't really know the Japanese scouting process.
I mean, it's changed in Japan, but I mean, it's still very much like ingrained that, you know, you have your home promotion. And while you do get, you know, more examples of like your Jake Lees that move around, like a lot of them, they stay loyal to that company. But now we're almost seeing like it's a graduation now to go to North America for an Okada, for Takeshita. Less so like your foreigners that I think it's always assumed they will go back permanently. But it's the Japanese stars now that yeah, I mean, Takeshita was like, he was like the guy for DDT. And then, you know, it took, you know, a while to work things out when he ended up going to AEW.
I wonder if even New Japan themselves knew exactly how good Konosuke Takeshita was until he, you know, was able to get onto AEW's platform and maybe, you know, have more high caliber matches with the rest of the world. The guy has just like gotten really, really good. And I think he's bulked up a lot too, to the point where he's a legitimate heavyweight. I was watching him in the G1 and I thought, wow, this guy would be a great replacement for Okada as the ace of the company, you know, with the championship hold, like having 5-star potential matches, you know, every single pay-per-view. But they don't have him. AEW does. And you just hope AEW uses him well, you know?
Well, I think it's such a misstep to not, like, it's just out of sight, out of mind when if you're just watching AEW. I'm not stating that you have to dedicate all this television time to Takeshita, but just to do something, that this guy is tearing it up in arguably the most famous wrestling tournament on an annual basis. He's killing it over there. Just to have Callis on commentary, like, you wouldn't even know he's in the G1. At the very least, on NXT, we got Charlie Dempsey mentioning that Tavion Heights is in the N1.
Yeah.
Josh Briggs is just selling injuries, I guess, but at least Tavion Heights and storyline is in a Japanese tournament.
I do think, though, we have an idea of like how AEW will be treating Takeshita's run in the G1, because it'll be the Lance Archer treatment.
Kingston. Like, it's just, there will be, maybe in passing when he comes back, it'll just be a line here or there. But I just think it's like, you get to bet. We're talking about how New Japan, like, they just can't capitalize off of this. AEW can. Like, they've got this guy. He's just like, I don't know. I would want to convey to my audience that one of my stars is just killing it in this tournament among all these greats, and he's coming back and he's going to be even more dangerous than he was before. Mm-hmm. And it just builds that anticipation. Like, you're getting the next evolution of Takeshita when he comes back after coming out of this tournament with this worldwide acclaim. And all it takes is just some mentions by the commentators every now and then, God forbid a quick 40-second video package. That's it. Okay. Soapbox. I am dispersing from.
Anthony Scott sends $2 to say, a friend put me in a figure four once. It's a shoot hold.
Well, in a wrestling program, everything is a shoot hold.
Yeah, but this one hurts even more than those other ones that also really hurt.
All right. Let's go to the forum. Andrew from Cape Breton, a pretty good Dynamite tonight. There didn't seem to be as much going on, but I guess with the weather, there were issues. It felt like the six-man tag got a lot of time, and they may have wanted to do more. There was also a lot more video packages than usual. The show was bookended by two great matches, which are part of why AEW is my favorite promotion. They were both great matches, but incredibly different from one another. And on the two women's matches, where their opponents looked like my G1 contest record, and you could have an overall good show. It wasn't a blowaway like weeks past, but AEW has been consistent. One negative I do want to bring up wasn't on the show, but what do you think the Tony Khan angle with the Bucks a few months ago, how it should have been done? While I thought it was great at the time, it didn't lead to anything, and the Bucks were defeated recently in Blood and Guts. I feel they'll end up losing the belts at All In, and I don't know what would be next for them. I mean, you could go into this a lot. I think at the bare minimum, when they did the angle with Tony, he should have been, like, it should have been done where he is out of power. He is incapacitated because the return meant nothing. Like, why? How is the power structure any different than before the Bucks turned and attacked Tony Khan? It's the exact same power structure. Tony is at these shows every week in storyline and in reality. And we have rulings by the Bucks that are drunk with power. We have Christopher Daniels, who was there to represent Tony Khan. He's still there. We have more power than ever on Tony Khan's side. It's a big issue to me, and one that I just don't think overall I'm fine with, like, the Okada involvement and the Elite as a group, but the story that connects them and this cancer towards AEW, I think that has missed the mark quite a bit in terms of what was, like, an A1 storyline. Like, this is not just a mid-card angle. This was, like, to be the focus of one of your top acts in the Young Bucks.
I think they could afford a lot more thought and a lot more clarity about exactly what the structure even is. We know what the Bucks have creative control, or to some extent, in their clauses, and Tony Khan can't do anything about it. But yet Tony Khan can overrule seemingly at will. But they also, like, don't think about the details of, like, why. Okay, so if Tony Khan can overrule Britt Baker's suspension, why did he wait a week to do it? Why didn't he just do it, you know, immediately upon finding out? There are things like that. There are also, like, I think there needs to be, like, acknowledgement of, like, what the thing is that is hanging above Tony Khan's head that he can't do anything about, so that we know what the resolution to this is. You know, there needs to be some sort of semblance of momentum towards this storyline ending, and we haven't had that. It just feels like it's just kind of a lingering thing that's going to exist potentially forever. And I think it's just contributed to making people maybe not care so much about it as well. Let's go to Matt Hahn, who sends a $5 super chat. Thank you, Matt. He says, when do you think we will get Takeshita versus Okada? That's my most anticipated AEW matchup.
Takeshita and Okada? I mean,
They're both heels at the moment. And I mean, if Takeshita comes back as a babyface, defects from the Callis family, and a lot of people are defecting from the Callis family at the moment. And so we wonder if they might delay that. But at the moment, they're kind of playing similar characters, I suppose you could say, in AEW. So we're probably not getting that match yet. But a question, I guess, is like, can you see Takeshita in the Continental Classic? You know,
I would hope so.
Because, man, that's a lot of wrestling that you're tipping on for that guy. But Okada as the Continental champion, I guess you would expect to be a part of it as well.
So maybe that's potential. Maybe that's your answer. Maybe towards the end of the year.
I would hold off on it until at least one of them is more of a solidified babyface. I'm thinking maybe Takeshita as a babyface versus a heel Okada. I also don't know if you would necessarily do it until you can give me assurance that Takeshita isn't just going to be in a role where he'll like be billed for a really hot match of the week and then he'll lose the match and then just kind of be forgotten about. Like, I want Takeshita to stand a chance at beating Okada, and I want that win to be a true elevation of Takeshita. Now, they're in the process of continuing to even build Okada, so I don't necessarily see that happening yet. This is all to say, like, I wouldn't mind if they held off on it, because I think there's a bigger story to be told between those two. Thank you very much. All right, let's go to Brian in New Jersey, who says, I thought MJF and Kyle Fletcher had the match of the night, and Danielson versus Jarrett was totally solid. I dug the image of those two fighting surrounded by fans in the concourse. Hook is the latest wrestler to sport an eye patch for an ankle, though it may have been overlooked because of his large calf. Nice that Britt Baker is back in the mix after a week off, and I hope any backstage drama involving her and MJF has been squashed quicker than Camille's two opponents. Very pleased that Beast Mortos has not been pinned in his last three AEW matches after seeing him be the fall guy for so long. Swerve continues to fire on all cylinders. I like the FTR acclaim beef heating up. While I felt Jim Ross is still there cognitively, his time on TV should be coming to an end. Question, there has been talk this week of the Lucha Brothers leaving AEW when their contracts come up this year, with Penta's coming up soon, so if they both make their way to the WWE afterward, how do you think they would do?
I think they'd do really well in this current WWE, whether it's NXT or the main roster. I think they're in a much better position than they would have been in years past. So I would be, I think it's, you know, it's a benefit of, you know, if you've been in a place long enough and you feel the need, like you have a great offer and you're going to get that instant refresher going to a new place in front of new fans. I think that those two are poised for great things if they were to go to WWE.
Yeah, especially as a tag team, where I think there's a lot more room for like them to make a name for themselves and just to simply like get over. Like, in ring, they're spectacular, and I have a lot more faith in the current version of the WWE that they will be allowed to wrestle the style that made them popular. Up until this point, I also think you could expect like really great sort of presentation with like all the bells and whistles you would expect out of the WWE that they didn't get in AEW. We're talking like incredible entrances, maybe name changes, you know, for the two of them, just because I don't exactly know like what the legal ramifications are for like Pentagon it being sort of like a brand. I could see WWE maybe wanting to push that just so they could sell the IP and the mass and all that. They will make a ton of money with those two. And I think they will do it all with sort of a bit of a feeling of showing perhaps the AEW audience that, hey, we can do what AEW did not, similar to maybe the effects of like a Cody Rhodes and a Jade Cargill.
Will they allow two Rays?
Yeah, that I don't know. I'm not sure. So, yeah.
Ray Arizona.
Ray Arizona. They can go with their Lucha Brother and King Phoenix is what they're all alternate.
They can name them anything. They can name them A1 and A2, and I'll be fine with it.
Yeah.
All right, let's do one more here. We'll go to Steve Grows Weed. No one wants Roosh's shirt, worst shirt ever. It makes no sense for Roderick Strong to team with Roosh and Mortos while the tag team that is part of his faction sits on the sidelines. I mean, they explained this was a rematch from last week where they beat the conglomeration. So, I mean, the three of them are all linked now with,
The reason is the Kingdom aren't that good, and Roderick Strong stands a better chance.
Don Callis needs to be have his guys utilized, so Roosh and Mortos are paired with Roddy.
Yeah, and Strong stands a better chance of beating the other two, the conglomeration, with these two instead.
He says, Swerve really should be holding the title through All In. I know he won't. Does he mean, like, after All In? I think he's going to hold on to it through All In. but he most definitely doesn't feel done yet as a champion. Jarrett was very impressive tonight. Never thought I'd say that, especially in 2024.
Well, if like if Hangman wins this gauntlet, or if Hangman just like simply challenges for the championship at All In, like I think a lot of us are expecting to, then yeah, obviously you would expect Swerve to retain. That would also mean Brian would have to retire, so maybe a lot of us don't expect that. Swerve versus Hangman could take place without the championship, and that would, I guess, leave the gauntlet wide open, you know, for somebody else.
All possible. All right, everybody.
So that's it. Yep.
Thank you for all of your feedback and for tuning in tonight. We appreciate it as always. On Thursday, we have got another G1 show coming your way as Eric Marcotte and Bruce Lord are going to be covering day number 13. And then Wei and I are back on Friday night. Rewind to SmackDown returns in its normal time slot after being preempted due to Olympic coverage last week. We are back Friday night, 10 Eastern, after SmackDown. We'll be taking calls. We'll be going through SmackDown from wherever it's taking place on Friday night. I think, I don't know where they are.
Roman Reigns back.
Roman Reigns is back. That's the big thing on SmackDown on Friday. And then coming up this weekend, Collision Course will be coming your way on Saturday night. So check out all of that and lots of great stuff coming up on the Cafe feed for the rest of the month that is non-G1 related. We will have all of our G1 coverage through the end of the tournament on the 18th. But also, next week, we'll be covering WrestleMania 10 on Rewind Away. We've got a mailbag show to get in before the end of the month. And if you are a double espresso member, back-to-back days this week of audio updates, and you never know when they're going to be dropping, catching you up to speed on the news out there in the world of pro wrestling and mixed martial arts. So that's it for us. Thanks for tuning in, and we will speak with you later this week.